Bad as this broken tech looked, Fitz hoped the engineers and scientists could still do something useful with them.
That's what so many of my bros died for, huh?
Said Martin. The sole wolfhound who hadn't been injured was walking close by and helping one of his comrades, a blonde-haired man named Lawrence. Blood-soaked bandages were wrapped around Lawrence's arm where the cannibals had sliced off a piece of muscle and skin, then singed the wound closed.
It's going to work,
Lawrence said, eyes bleary. He still seemed to be in shock.
These guys know what they're doing. That butchered arm of yours is screwing with your brain if you think they got a single damn idea of what's going on.
Quiet, Fitz said. We're going to get you guys out of here, but you have to cooperate.
Fitz took a moment to scan the rest of them. A big dark-skinned man named Jackson was on Rico's back in a fireman's carry. Both his legs had been chopped off by the cannibals. The cauterized stumps leaked yellow fluids into sodden bandages. His face had grown a shade paler since they had begun their hike away from the warehouses, and Fitz wasn't sure if he was going to make it. He'd been unconscious nearly the entire time. Ace had a man with a scraggly beard and olive-green eyes, Hopkins in a similar carry. Every bump, every jostle sent the man groaning in pain. His right foot was missing below the ankle. Mendez was at least walking on his own, watching their backs on rear guard.
Put me down, Hopkins begged.
Fitz remembered the guy bravely working with them to infiltrate the cannibals' base before, but all sense of bravery was gone.
Put me down and leave me, he mumbled.
For a second, Fitz thought that maybe they would be better off leaving the injured wolfhounds behind and coming back for them. Team Ghost could make it to the C-130H faster without them, secure it, and then return. He shook the thoughts from his head. That was just exhaustion speaking. The last dregs of adrenaline had burned off, and they were faced with a stark, demoralizing reality. Leaving any wolfhound behind was condemning them to death, either to their own wounds, starving variants, or to the unknown enemies that had tried to cut them down from the choppers. He already felt responsible for the extreme loss of life. Fitz motioned for the group to gather around the charred husk of a delivery truck. He looked around at the weary, ash-covered faces.
We're almost to the edge of the campus, Fitz said. From there, we hike straight back to the C-130. If the choppers come back, split and run. Rendezvous is the LZ. Clear?
Several nods.
Seriously, just leave me,
Hopkins said, eyes bleary.
You guys would do better without us dragging you down. You still got a mission, and we're holding you back.
We ain't leaving nobody, Mendez grunted.
Keep quiet, Fitz ordered. There might still be cannibals or variants out there.
Dohai led them down the street toward the freeway. The odor of cooked flesh drifted through the air. Rubble lay at the feet of the buildings. Flames still licked piles of debris. The team passed melted vehicles scattered along the cracked parking lot. A cluster of corpses were just ahead, skeletal remains frozen in agony where they had fallen to gunfire or flames. Fitz passed a truck with a missing windshield. A cannibal gunner had been posted inside. His rifle lay outside the driver's side window, and his skeletal hands were stretched out as if he had been trying to escape when the rockets hit. Charred muscles had shrunken into ghastly cables over his long bones. Not much remained of his face except his open jaw from when the man had let out a permanent, silent scream. Fitz felt a hint of sympathy. The cannibals had been cruel, twisted human beings, but seeing even them slaughtered like this was hard to stomach. That feeling quickly evaporated when they passed over the highway. He took the team past the location where Lieutenant Singh and the other wolfhounds had been positioned.
Oh, God, no,
Martin choked. Lawrence leaned on him, face frozen in shock.
You still think these assholes know what they're doing? Martin asked.
Lawrence didn't answer this time. At the edge of the woods, mangled body parts surrounded bloodied craters. Bullet holes perforated tree trunks. Other trunks had been turned into splinters by rockets.
This is all your goddamn fault, Martin mumbled.
Fitz heard it, but ignored the man. He went to Mendez and glassed the freeway to make sure they weren't being followed.
We have to bury them, Martin said.
Fitz turned to see him picking up an arm and a leg. That's when he knew Martin had lost it.
Come on, man, Lawrence said, holding his wounded arm. You need to trust them. We gotta keep going. Gotta get to that C-130.
He's right, Fitz said.
Martin glared at him, but then nodded, pulling himself together. Rico lugged Jackson over.
We got a problem, she said.
What's up?
He's burning up from an infection, and it's bad. The antibiotics we gave him from the field kit aren't doing anything.
We've got more on the plane, Fitz said. Come on, let's move out.
Rico took in a deep breath and then kept walking with Jackson on her back. An hour of slow moving took them around the booby traps in the forest. When Fitz heard the popping of joints, he signaled the team to halt. It sounded like it was coming from one of the pits. He crept to the edge and peered over the side of it. A variant writhed on a stake piercing its abdomen. Bloodshot reptilian eyes locked onto his as its long tongue lashed the air. He made sure the others saw it before moving on. The message was clear. Variants were still prowling these woods to find scraps from the battle. The team trudged onward as the early morning hours turned to noon. The sun hung high overhead. Eventually, they reached the beginning of the cliffside trail that would take them down to the beach-turned-landing strip. Fitz wanted to sprint ahead and search for the wolfhounds defending the C-130.
Hold up, Rico said.
She gently laid Jackson on the ground. Fitz joined her after signaling to Dohai, Ace, and Mendez to hold security. Rico knelt beside Jackson, her fingers against his wrist. His dark skin was covered in beads of sweat, and his lips were dry and cracked. Fitz bent down.
Pulse is weak, Rico said.
She tried to drip water from her hydration pack into his mouth. He choked on the dribble, erupting in a racking cough.
We're almost there, Fitz said. Hang on, Jackson.
A rotten odor drifted away from the bandages around his legs, no doubt from the festering infections. Rico tried to give Jackson more water. A low noise gurgled at the back of his throat like he was trying to talk, but then he went quiet, and his head tilted to the side.
Almost there, Fitz repeated to Rico to reassure himself as much as her. You need help?
Rico shook her head, then loaded the man on her back again.
He's not that heavy, to be honest.
Dohai waited for Fitz's signal before taking them to the edge of an abrupt cliff. The blue waves of the Pacific gleamed in the sunlight, and Fitz walked up to the edge. Beneath them stretched the long, sandy beach where the C-130 and the wolfhounds were supposed to be waiting. A breath caught in his chest when he saw half-buried corpses and weapons scattered along the coast. The C-130 looked like a spent firecracker, half its fuselage torn open and leaking charcoaled supplies.
Keep them away, Fitz said to Ace.
The wolfhounds had been through enough, and he didn't want them to lose hope.
But Fitz felt defeated, like the eroding beach in front of them, slammed over and over by waves.
Ace moved in front of Martin and Lawrence to keep them from looking.
What? Martin said.
He had set his pack down again and was holding his gold necklace like it was the only thing keeping his mind in control.
What is it?
Ace put a hand in front of Martin's chest.
Hold on, man. We've got to make sure things are clear.
Fitz crouched next to Rico. She pointed to movement inside the cockpit. He shouldered his rifle and peered through its optics, zooming in on the fractured plexiglass around the cockpit. Through one missing panel, he saw what had caught her attention. A starving variant tore at the neck of a dead pilot. Needle-sharp teeth came away from the flesh with strings of bloody sinew. Fitz cursed their luck. Everything that could have gone wrong had. That's not exactly true, he thought. His team was still alive. Bringing up his rifle, Fitz waited for a good shot, but Dohai grabbed him by the shoulder.
Boss, you need to see this, he said quietly.
Fitz followed him to another vantage point.
10 o'clock, Dohai whispered.
Fitz used his scope again, but all he saw were seagulls swooping in to feast on the dead. Then he saw a camouflaged Zodiac on the shore.
Using his scope, he followed footprints in the sand from the small boat to the plane. Dohai held up a pair of binoculars, indicating a spot further out over the ocean. He handed over the binos, and Fitz zoomed in on a ship just barely visible on the horizon. When he squinted, he thought he saw the shape of two choppers resting on its deck. Now he knew where the hostiles had refueled their birds. But how in the hell did they get a ship and equipment like this? He handed the binos back and aimed his rifle on the C-130 when Rico stumbled over. She crouched down, shaking her head incredulously.
"Fitz, you're not going to believe this," she said.
Dohai and Fitz both looked at her as they crouched.
"What?" "It's a variant, but it's also a man."
Rico shook her head again.
"Just look at the damn plane again."
Fitz and Dohai both got back up behind the rock cover and used their rifles to view the figures that had emerged outside the destroyed aircraft. Not one, but three men walked out of the wreckage, blood dripping down their chins. A deep pang of terror shot through him when he saw their yellow reptilian eyes and maws filled with jagged teeth. These weren't men, at least not entirely. These were some sort of variant human crossbreeds, and they were carrying rifles.
"They're like chimeras," Rico said. "Half variant, half human."
"Chimeras,"
Fitz repeated, thinking of the horrifying amalgam of creatures that comprised the legendary monster in Greek mythology. He thought he had seen the worst combinations of nature and science in Europe, but now he realized those mutated creatures paled in comparison to the things standing on the beach. These crooked half-beasts were exactly what the VX-99 program had set out to create all those years ago in Vietnam. The perfect soldier. Kate waited at the top of the metal stairs that would take her and her team into the bowels of variant hell. A warm wind blew out of the hole at the construction site. If she stared too long into the abyss, she could almost hear the whispers and moans of all the people that the beasts had taken down there. The scratch and click of scuttling variants, the shrieks of an alpha commanding the beasts. Beckham stepped beside her, and the fear slowly subsided.
"Nothing we haven't seen before, so try not to worry," he said. "We got plenty of security, and I'll be right here."
Her husband was half right about the first part. Kate had seen the creatures both in her lab and out more times than she cared to count. She had also experimented with the webbing and worked on a mastermind. But she had never been inside one of their tunnels or lairs.
"It's not just the beasts I'm worried about," she said. "It's what they brought down here."
The thrumming chop of an incoming helicopter commanded her attention. Outpost soldiers posted around the construction site retreated to the wide lawn that had been serving as the outpost's helipad. Fisher had been hanging out near them with his guards and walked over toward Beckham and Kate. Kate shielded her eyes against the midday sun. The silhouette of a Blackhawk descended toward the memorial park.
"That must be my team," she said.
Fisher joined them, dipping his cowboy hat.
"Just got word that my fiber-size equipment will be here in a few hours," he said. "I'm going to take a ride outside the walls to scout locations for it."
"Good luck," Beckham said.
"You too,"
Fisher said, dipping his hat again. Kate watched the chopper disappear behind a line of trees. Only 30 seconds passed before it lifted back into the sky. The soldiers that had departed at its arrival returned now, escorting the technicians that would assist Kate in hooking up their computers to tap into the organic variant network. She recognized Ron, with his buzzed head and bandages covering wounds from Manchester. Leslie was here too, her long blonde hair tied in a ponytail. Between them walked someone Kate hadn't expected.
"Sammy," she yelled.
The computer engineer limped, one tattooed arm clamped over her abdomen. Kate ran to her.
"What are you doing here? You're supposed to be resting," Kate said.
"We tried to tell her that," Leslie said.
"She doesn't listen,"
Ron added. Sammy cracked a pained smile.
"You think I trust a bunch of biologists with my computer program? Seriously, though, are you sure you're up for this?" Kate asked.
Look, we need to infiltrate the variant network as fast as possible, Sammy said. I developed the software, and I don't think anyone here understands communication networks as well as I do.
Kate sighed. She wasn't going to argue with Sammy, because as much as she hated to admit it, the engineer was right. They absolutely needed her.
Can we get some help with this stuff?
Ron asked, pointing to a few crates that the soldiers had helped carry from their chopper.
What is all this? Beckham asked.
Splash suits and masks, Leslie said. We're going underground. There might be contaminants, airborne and otherwise. This will help protect us.
Understood.
Beckham directed a few soldiers to open the supply crates.
Wait, we're going down there?
Ron asked, peering down into the pit. Leslie stepped up for a look.
We've got plenty of soldiers to protect us, Kate said. And my husband is taking the lead.
Good enough for me, Sammy said.
Beckham gave orders to the other guards. There were 12 in total, all armed with rifles and decked out in body armor. Kate looked to Ron.
Do you have everything we need?
He shrugged his backpack off his shoulder and opened it to reveal its contents.
2 laptops, 1 spare, and a handful of flexible microelectric arrays.
Good, Kate said.
Let's suit up.
Ron and Leslie helped the soldiers into splash suit coveralls. They taped their boots and gloves and fitted each with a full face mask respirator. Sammy gave Beckham a wrist monitor that reported oxygen and temperature levels to help gauge the tunnel's environmental compatibility. Once the soldiers were outfitted, the science team donned their protective gear, each strapping on wrist monitors of their own. Kate took in a breath, smelling the slight plastic odor of the rebreather system.
After you, Captain, Kate said.
Beckham led the way down the metal stairs into the old sewer line. Hot air emanated from inside like they were entering the throat of a giant beast.
What's with the heat? Ron asked.
Kate threw up a finger at the technician. She wasn't a soldier, but she knew the value of quiet when infiltrating unknown territory, even if you had been told it was likely safe. From all her time with Beckham, she had soaked in a few lessons. It was the only way to survive, as long as they had. Once they hit the bottom of the stairs, the tunnel curved into a relatively flat floor. Their boots slurped over fragments of the red webbing that had been destroyed by the demolition team prior to Kate and her team's arrival. A demolitions team had rigged C4 charges throughout the tunnels with lines snaking away to the detonators. Seeing the explosive charges didn't bother Kate, but the rising temperature did. It was a good 15 degrees hotter already. Beckham flipped on his tactical light as they left the reach of the sun. Beams of white light with target designators speared the darkness from a dozen rifles. Leslie gasped.
Holy shit, Ron said.
Hunks of variant body parts littered the area beyond an iron gate that the outpost engineers had installed earlier that day. Beckham and the other soldiers shone their lights through the bars. They raked the beams back and forth before unlocking the gate. The passage was only about 10 yards wide and another 6 tall, but it was one of the largest Kate had heard about. This old sewer line was a major artery of transport and communication for the variants. Exactly the kind of place they needed to tap into. Much of the webbing on the walls had burned to a crisp. In other areas, crimson ropes hung loose as if they had been torn by claws and bullets. Tangles of the webbing farther down still pulsed on their own, tendrils squirming like worms cut in half. While segmented chunks of webbing lined the walls and floor, Kate couldn't be sure that they were connected with the main network. With the damage in this part of the tunnel, she had a hard time figuring out if any piece of webbing connected to the masterminds and other variants miles from their location. For their efforts to succeed, they needed an intact section, untouched by the demolition team. One that led to the larger network of tunnels and webbing that connected the masterminds. That was the only way to truly tap into the variant and collaborator communications. And that meant they had to go deeper. Kate explained, and Beckham took in a deep breath.
Okay, follow me, he said.
The further they traveled, the worse the stench grew. Somewhere in the distance, water dripped from the ceiling. Beckham stopped a handful of times, and Kate listened for the popping of joints or growls of the beasts. All she heard was the constant drip and trickle of water. They pushed onward. Another gust of warm wind traveled through the passage a few minutes later. Kate shivered from a sound that came with that wind. A slight rustling mixed with ghostly moans.
"I got movement," said one of the soldiers.
Beckham signaled for two soldiers to follow him and investigate as the others held positions around the science team. Kate froze and watched her husband move into the darkness. The lights bobbed, chasing away the shadows as their guns swept across the tunnel. Beckham's light landed on a long crimson tendril that strained and quivered slightly.
"Just the webbing," said the other soldier.
He pulled out a knife and touched it with the blade. As soon as he did, something dropped from the ceiling. He nearly tripped, stumbling backward as he brought up his rifle.
"Hold your fire," Beckham said.
He trained his light on a cocoon of red that had dropped from the snapped webbing. Kate took a few steps forward.
"My God," Beckham said.
The soldier with the knife knelt next to the cocoon. Beckham bent down and took out his blade too. They carefully cut at the fibers. The scarlet vines fell away to reveal a shriveled, skinny man with gaping wounds in his side. Teeth and claw marks covered his body, and he let out a long, agonized moan.
"Jesus," said the soldier with Beckham.
The other guards advanced around them to hold security, and Kate moved over to help. She looked down the tunnel as the beams penetrated the inky darkness. All along the ceiling and walls were other cocoons strung up in the webbing. People squirmed in a few of them. Others were completely still, the occupants unconscious or long since dead. Beckham pulled out his radio.
"Command Alpha 1, we found some of your missing people. Requesting additional support, medical included."
The transmission didn't go through, and he turned, giving orders for one of the soldiers to go back and get help. Then he sent two of the other guards to clear more of the tunnel and free as many survivors as they could while they waited for backup. Kate steeled herself as she heard the slurp of prisoners being let loose from the webbing. Beckham walked back over to her.
"Is this place good enough to tap into the network?" he asked.
Kate looked to Sammy.
"What do you think?"
"This is as good as it gets in terms of network density," Sammy said.
"Let's try it," Kate said, trying to keep it together. She tried to take her gaze from the human prisoners with their horrifying wounds, but it was almost impossible. And she pictured her friends and family strung up in tunnels just like this. Of all the places she had worked in the past, this was the worst. But her team had no choice. If they wanted to ensure the future of the Allied States didn't end up like this, they had to tap into the variant network.
5.
Dohai perched amid the windswept trees and bushes on a cliff overlooking the wreckage of the C-130. Past it, waves crashed over the shore. He watched three chimeras sift through the ruins of the plane. Outside the wreckage, two of the half-breed beasts fed on the corpses of the wolfhounds scattered across the sand and rocks. Mendez lay prone beside Dohai, surveying the macabre scene with his binos. Deeper in the woods behind them, the rest of Team Ghost monitored Hopkins, Lawrence, and Jackson. The injured trio continued to decline. Jackson was still unconscious, both of his injured legs looking worse. While Hopkins could manage to stand on one leg, there was no way he could walk unassisted with his missing foot. He continued to beg Team Ghost to go on without the three of them, insisting they were nothing but a burden. Even Lawrence, with only an injured arm, now looked pale as a sheet. His eyes had turned glassy, and he seemed in a constant state of shock. The trio needed antibiotics and better medical attention than Ghost could provide with their already depleted field kits.
"Looks like those things might be backing up," Mendez said.
"Go tell Fitz," Dohai whispered back.
Mendez nodded, then disappeared into the shroud of leaves and branches behind them. Dohai watched over the beach. He still struggled to understand how these half-man monsters were even possible. When the variants bred, they spawned armored juveniles. But he'd never seen a juvenile that looked so human. These were something else. something more intelligent that could use a rifle and operate vehicles. A terrifying abomination that the VX-99 had been designed for back in Vietnam. Fitz crawled up beside Dohai.
"Where the hell did they come from anyway with that kind of firepower?" he asked. "I noticed their ACUs had the California National Guard emblem on them," Dohai replied.
Mendez got down next to them.
"You think these things were guardsmen?"
Dohai shook his head.
"No, but I think they ransacked the National Guard armories and bases around the bay."
"Makes sense," Fitz said.
"We've neglected the West Coast for years. They must have been stockpiling supplies we abandoned out here."
"If they were out here so long, why did they leave the cannibals alone until now?" Mendez asked.
"Because the cannibals weren't the real threat," Dohai said. "We are."
Dohai brought his rifle up and peered through the scope. One of the Chimeras tied up a large canvas bag near the Zodiac, then heaved it on the boat.
"What did he take?" Fitz whispered.
"I don't know," Dohai said.
They watched for another few moments, until the answer became clear. A second beast emerged from the wrecked plane with another large bag and dropped it into the boat. The third was crouched near a crater in the sand. He clawed through the mangled body parts, then picked up a charred leg. After sniffing it, he stuffed it into his bag.
"Dinner," Mendez said.
He crossed his chest. Dohai felt a bout of nausea well up in his stomach.
"Act like soldiers, look like beasts, and eat like them," Mendez said. "Worse than variants because they seem as smart as humans."
"Someone must have still been developing VX-99, Fitz said. "We've got to tell Dr. Lovato. This is more important than the SDS tech."
Fitz was right. The creatures in front of them combined the worst of both nature and man in one biological package. The beasts hoisted a couple more packs over their shoulders and then dragged their Zodiac back into the surf. Two hopped in while the third kept pushing the boat into the waves.
"Get ready to move," Fitz said. "Mendez, stay on watch. Signal us if something's wrong. Dohai, you and I will search the C-130 for a radio and medical supplies."
Dohai led at Fitz's command, and they crept down the trail until they reached the beach. Their boots crunched over the sand as they approached the aftermath of the carnage. Only a few wolfhound bodies had been left behind, and they were already stripped of meat. The wind had swept sand over a boot with half a leg sticking out. A helmet protruded out of a sand mound, the soldier's mangled face partially exposed. Dohai crept up to the fuselage of the C-130. Metal panels peeled off the side of the plane like a giant had slammed an axe into the hull. Fitz gestured for Dohai to lead. He entered the plane at a crouch, hit by the acrid scent of burned plastic that made his eyes water. The stench of carrion came next. Dohai stepped over the melted jump seats and broken ammo crates. He kept his rifle shouldered, peering down the length of the C-130. When he was sure it was clear, he motioned to Fitz.
"See if you can find some antibiotics. I'll check the radio," Fitz said.
He navigated the wreckage to reach the cockpit, pushing past a few tumbled crates. Dohai stepped over a dead man lying in a puddle of dried blood. Chunks of flesh and muscle were missing from his neck, teeth marks scarring the bits of skin left under the shredded remains of his clothes. The smell only grew worse as Dohai pushed aside a few half-eaten corpses in his way. He reached the tail of the plane. A metal crate was marked with a white cross over red paint. He unlatched the crate and opened the lid. There were a few rolls of gauze and bandages, but that was it. No blister packs with pills, no antibiotic sprays.
"What the hell?" Dohai asked, examining the crate.
Then he noticed the scratches in the paint. They looked like claw marks. He started back up toward the cockpit, checking the ammo crates on the way. They were empty, too. The Chimeras had scavenged all these supplies. The only thing they seemed to have left were a couple self-inflating emergency life rafts. Probably had no use for them, given they were motoring around in that Zodiac. He reached the cockpit, where Fitz was trying the controls of the radio.
Everything's broke, Dick, Fitz said.
Dohai examined the radio. It was warped and melted. Bullet holes showed where the variant soldiers had fired into it for good measure.
No ride out of here, and no way to contact anybody back east, Fitz said. Did you find anything useful back there? They took everything. Ammunition, extra weapons, medical supplies.
Fitz cursed, hanging his head low. Then he glanced out the cracked window of the cockpit. Dohai followed his gaze to the ship on the horizon.
They must have taken everything. But they haven't left yet, Fitz said. If we can find a way to get out there, then maybe we can steal what we need and get away without being noticed. Maybe.
Dohai knew it was a long shot, but they had no other choice.
We have to warn command about the Chimeras, Fitz said. They have to know. It's going to be a huge risk, even if we do find a way to get out there before they sail away. We better get moving then, Fitz said. We have no time to waste.
Fisher waited inside a large garage with Tran and Chase. 10 outpost soldiers milled around them, ready to head out with them into the city. The clank of tools and voices of mechanics working on 2 MATVs, a Humvee, and a pickup truck echoed throughout the cold space. There were other vehicles, including a snowplow. The edges of the blade were covered in paint that looked like it had been scraped off other cars. As soon as the vehicles were fueled and ready, they would head out to scout locations for the vibro-sized trucks already en route from El Paso. The oil and gas exploration vehicles weren't the sophisticated seismic detection equipment from Project Rolling Stone that General Cornelius had wanted, but it would have to do for now. While Fisher waited, he loaded shells into his new tactical shotgun. Then he counted the bullets for his .357 Magnum. He had only 20 left. There were only a few surviving outposts that manufactured ammunition, including Outpost Galveston under the command of General Cornelius. Even so, bullets were becoming rarer every day, especially with the threat of those outposts being lost as the enemy advanced. That's what scared him so much about the collaborators. They seemed to have access to fuel, weapons, ammunition, and vehicles. There were rumors now they even had helicopters. If that were true, the traitorous bastards were in better shape than what was left of the Allied States. Tran and Chase finished loading up extra magazines for their M4 rifles. There were still plenty of the 5.56mm and 7.62mm ammo left for now, but their stock would be gone in a few days if they didn't get a resupply and the variants pressed their attack. If the outpost survives that long. That's exactly what Fisher and his men were here for, to make sure the outpost didn't fall while Kate and her team tapped into the variant network. As soon as they figured out where the real mastermind was, it would be the beginning of the end for the monsters.
Good to go,
shouted a husky man with a long brown beard.
Let's mount up.
The vehicles growled to life inside the open garage, the noise rumbling like dragons waking from slumber.
Wait up, yelled a female voice.
Colonel Amber Massey jogged over in fatigues. A duty belt holding a pistol, extra magazines, and a radio hung from her waist. She also carried an MP5 submachine gun. As the other soldiers loaded up, the large man with the beard walked over to her.
Commander,
he said in a deep voice.
Sergeant Bonner, I'll be driving them, she said, gesturing toward Fisher and his men. And we're taking Black Betty.
You got it, ma'am,
said Bonner. He tossed her a set of keys. She caught them midair and jerked her chin for Fisher and his bodyguards. They followed her to a black pickup truck on a lift with oversized tires. Bars covered the side windows, and a cow guard with spikes masked the grill.
Looks like something from Mad Max, Tran said quietly.
Fisher grinned, but said nothing. Commander Massey climbed up to the driver's seat. The three men used the footholds to climb up into the dual cab. Bonner drove the Humvee out first, and the MATVs followed, with Black Betty going last. The trucks slowly drove away from the building and down a street inside the perimeter of the outpost. As they drove, Fisher spotted what looked like medical crews carrying stretchers away from the fenced-off area around the construction site where Kate and Beckham were working.
What's going on?
He asked. Massey sighed.
The science team discovered survivors.
Survivors?
Tran asked. She glanced in the rearview mirror. If you can call them that. Her words were cold, but he sensed the sorrow behind them. Some of our people have been taken underground over the past few weeks, she added, her tone gravely serious. The few people we rescued might be here physically, but their minds sure aren't. Fisher swallowed hard, thinking about the horror these people had experienced. He recalled the tunnels at his fields. I could have been one of them. It hadn't really sunk in until now, how lucky he had been. The clanking of a metal gate sounded over the rumble of engines. He turned to see the first gate in the outpost wall lifting. The convoy rolled forward, prompting the guards to open the second gate. You boys ready to see New York City? Massey asked.
Ready as I'll ever be, Fisher said.
Truth was, he had never really liked the city. Too loud, too dirty, and too muggy in the summer. But he would have taken it back then compared to what it looked like now. Destruction surrounded them in all directions, above, below, on the ground. And even with the windows up, they couldn't escape the odor. The city smelled like death. Mangled vehicles flashed by, blackened and crushed from firebombs. Massey sped ahead of the convoy, taking the lead. All right, you're the boss, she said. Tell me where you think the best place is for your trucks. She eased off the gas until they were cruising at about 25 miles per hour. The street was mostly cleared of debris and vehicles, probably from the plow he had seen back in the garage. Plastic and broken glass carpeted the sidewalks outside storefronts where windows had been blown away. Most of the doors to buildings were gone. Fisher pulled a map he had requested earlier from his vest pocket. On it, Massey's people had marked areas indicating the sites of previous variant attacks. He ignored the subways and tunnels Massey's people had already plugged and or demolished.
Let's start around City Hall Park, he said.
She took a right and drove to the park. The few trees still alive had lost most of their leaves, giving him a view of City Hall. The building had collapsed inward from an explosion, and the resulting mountain of debris blocked his view of the other side of the park. Still, there was plenty of room for a truck in the closest section of the lawn.
This spot is worth checking out, he said.
The convoy stopped, and he opened the door.
Whoa, I don't think so, Mr. Fisher, Massey said, reaching toward him. Not safe to wander around right now. There could be variants prowling.
Fisher hesitated, one leg already out.
Well, how am I supposed to see if these locations are good if I can't get out and survey them?
You can't tell from the truck?
Not really, he said. I need to walk the ground a bit.
She pulled out her radio.
We're getting out here, she said. Secure the area, then form a perimeter.
Fisher stepped down to the pavement, his shotgun in hand. The park was bordered by a few major streets. Tunnels from subways, sewers, and water lines stretched underneath them. This would be a likely route to the outpost. Having a truck positioned here would ensure they knew right away if the creatures were traversing those underground pathways. First, they would have to clear the intersection of Park Row and Broadway.
Commander Massey, can you get your plow out here to move those? He asked,
pointing to the vehicles clogging the streets.
Sure, I'll call it in when we get back.
Good, he said, marking his map.
This location is perfect.
After scoping out the rest of the park, he went back to the convoy.
Where to now? Massey asked.
The Gardist Garden, Fisher replied. They drove to a small park between Hudson and West Broadway. The trees were gone, destroyed during the war, leaving a wide space for another vibro-sized truck.
Looks good, Fisher marked it.
This time, his view was clear enough he didn't need to get out. An hour later, his map had been marked with multiple locations surrounding the outpost, forming a rough square. There was one location left to examine, and that was Pump House Park near the shoreline of the Hudson River. They parked in a circle drive at South End Avenue, right next to the park. The trees here were all alive, though their branches were mostly naked from the changing seasons. Fisher got out of the truck for a better look, and the outpost soldiers followed his lead.
Commander Massey and Sergeant Bonner trailed him down a sidewalk.
You sure this is a good place? Massey asked. So close to the shore and all? It's not ideal, but it's the last blind spot.
A scream cut him off, followed by the pop of a gunshot. The team whirled around with their weapons aimed at the Circle Drive and their vehicles. Four of the soldiers ran toward Liberty Street, where the screaming continued.
Come on,
Bonner yelled. Fisher spotted the source of the screams. A man was being dragged by a hulking variant down the road. Gunshots rang out, and bullets punched into the bulky monster as it pulled him toward an open manhole. The creature vanished down the manhole with the soldier. A long scream echoed out of the opening. Two soldiers rushed toward the open hole, rifles shouldered. One flicked on a flashlight and shone the beam in, but instead of going down, the other guy pushed the cover back over the top.
What are you doing? Fisher asked.
He's gone, Massey said. Nothing we can do for him now. The rest of the team retreated to the convoy, and Bonner waved for Fisher and his men to get back into the trucks. He stood there a moment, just staring, before finally retreating to the truck with Massey. No one said anything until they were back in the cab. She grabbed the radio off the dashboard and brought it up to give an order.
Get the demo team to collapse that tunnel. But that soldier might still be alive, Fisher protested.
We're doing him a favor. She put the radio down and placed the vehicle in gear. When we get back, I'll show you what's left of the people we find down there.
6. Timothy took a slug of water from a canteen they had scavenged. Every step he took, his body and legs felt weaker and heavier. Soon he feared he would crash if they didn't rest. For the past 10 hours, he had followed Sergeant Ruckley and Corporal Nealand away from the variant-infested area around Outpost Portland. They hadn't found a radio or any help. The two Army Rangers were the only survivors from their platoon. A few hours earlier, Ruckley had discovered soldiers that appeared to have survived the initial bombing, but bullet wounds in their temples indicated they had been executed in cold blood. She was still reeling from the find, and Timothy had seen her shed a few tears. The soldiers weren't the only people they had found with bullet holes in their heads. Civilians had been murdered and left as scraps for the scattered variants. Evil ran deep through collaborators like Nick and Pete. Timothy wondered if they were still out there. A variant's long wail snapped him from his thoughts of revenge. Ruckley waved for them to take cover. They took cover in the shade of a bridge extending over a creek. Evading the random variants during their escape wasn't easy. The beasts were actively hunting for new prey.
Why don't we just kill them? Nealand whispered.
Because our gunfire will attract more, Ruckley said.
Shit, even Timothy knew that.
We've got knives, Nealand said. It would be quiet.
Timothy shrugged, but Ruckley shook her head.
We wait them out, she said. We're not going to take more risks than we have to.
For the next 15 minutes, they remained under the bridge. Two of the creatures clattered over the pavement above. Timothy heard one pause and snort as it sniffed the air for human flesh. He shouldered the M4 he had pulled off a dead soldier. There was a suppressor on the end, but he wasn't sure that would matter. The monsters could hear a needle drop. Timothy tensed at a distant scream. It was faint, almost like a whisper on the wind. The sound wasn't from a monster. Ruckley perked up like she heard it too. The frightened shriek came again. This time the two beasts on the bridge bounded away, claws scratching on the pavement. Ruckley signaled for Nealand and Timothy to follow. They climbed up the muddy bank back to the main road. The beasts, on all fours, took off onto a front lawn and into a backyard of a house along the street. Ruckley started in the opposite direction.
Wait, what about helping that person? Timothy asked.
We don't know who they are, and chances are they're already dead, she said. We got bigger problems.
Timothy didn't care who they were, friend or collaborator. If they were the latter, all the better. Fuck it, he thought. He took off running from Ruckley and Nealand. It took him a moment to realize they weren't following, but he kept going. Another scream exploded from somewhere ahead, and a second voice called out. This one a male.
Shelley!
It didn't sound like these were collaborators, but it could be a trap. If they were collaborators, he would try and take them alive. Maybe they could lead him to Nick and Pete. He ran hard, his shoes pounding the pavement until he got to the front yard the variants had cut through. The breeze rustled his sweaty clothing as he sprinted, but he had to slow down. All his muscles were locking up from dehydration. A glance over his shoulder confirmed the two Army Rangers weren't following. That surprised him, but they had made their decision, and he wasn't bound by Ruckley's orders. He was driven by only one directive, doing what his father would have. Shouldering his rifle, he followed the path the beasts had taken through the backyard. Another creek bordered the dying brown grass, separating the yard from two more houses up a hill. He jumped over the creek and sprinted up the slope. By the time he reached the front of the first house, the voices had quieted. He dropped low near the driveway to search the street to the left, then the right. Nothing moved except for shreds of torn clothing blowing in the parking lot of a church at the far end of the road. Timothy remembered this place now. A small community of people had survived off the grid here, living off the land and sea. The windows of the church were boarded up, but the front door was wide open. A sign in the front yard said, "Sanctuary for those that trust in him." Long red streaks stained the sidewalk leading to the open door. Timothy was too late. Halfway there, he paused at the familiar sound of popping joints. Then he heard the rip and crackle of tearing flesh, followed by the crack of bones. All the sounds came from inside the church. He searched outside for any beasts that might be watching before advancing toward the building. As he walked, he aimed his rifle at the open door, then peeked inside. In the shadows of the nave, he spotted a crouched figure bent over a body. Timothy moved his finger to his trigger, then squeezed off a burst of rounds into the variant's back. The monster let out a gurgling moan and collapsed. He lowered his rifle and stepped forward. Bodies were scattered inside the church, many already shredded into bloody ribbons. No matter how much death he witnessed, it would never get easier. Timothy considered whether he should go inside further to see if anyone was still alive. The chances were slim, but he had to check it out. There was a sound coming from near the altar, a low rasping, like someone having a hard time breathing. It grew louder as he approached between the pews. He aimed his rifle in the shadows until he saw red eyes glaring at him. Oh, shit. The rasping erupted into a vicious growl, then a guttural barking. Timothy took a step back and tripped as a mutated dog barreled down the central aisle. He went down on his butt and fired a burst that went high, punching into a pew, splinters spraying from the impact. Pushing himself up with one hand, he fired wildly with the other. Again, he missed the target. The creature followed him as he ran and leapt through the open door. The beast launched itself into the air. He brought up his rifle to knock it away. It barreled into him, jaws snapping and saliva spraying across his face. He hit the ground on his side, and the beast rolled onto the lawn. He managed to turn his rifle and fire. This time, the rounds blew off part of the hound's jaw. But the creature still came at him, blood whipping from its broken face until he sent a second burst into its ribs, taking it down. More barking sounded in the distance. A second dog charged from the backside of the church. With only a second to spare, Timothy swiveled his rifle and pulled the trigger. His bolt locked back. The magazine was empty. The creature jumped into the air. He only had a moment to bring up an arm to brace himself for the impact. A gunshot cracked in the distance. The monster crashed into Timothy, knocking him to the ground. He rolled away, ready to fight, but the abomination was already limp. Timothy pushed himself up to see Neeland lowering his rifle. Ruckley ran toward the church. Her face burned red and her nose twitched. She looked like she was biting back a mouthful of curses. Neeland kept his rifle trained on the church door while she jabbed Timothy's chest with a finger. "You ever do that again and I'll leave you behind, you stupid shit," she said through a clenched jaw. "You got it? I'm sorry, but there were people. They were already dead and you know it." Timothy didn't exactly agree, but nodded anyway. "I want to hear you say it. I will follow your orders, Sergeant," Ruckley said. Timothy thought again about what his dad would have done.
You listening to me? Ruckley said.
Yes. If you're with me, you follow my orders, she said. Those gunshots probably attracted more of the beasts.
Okay,
Timothy said.
Let's go, Nealon said.
Ruckley turned and started walking.
Where are we going?
Timothy asked. Outpost Boston, unless we find a radio and or a ride before that, she said without turning. Timothy followed her, relieved she hadn't made him promise to follow her orders. If she turned her back on defenseless people again or didn't go after the collaborators, then he would again do what he'd just done. She had a mission, and so did he. Hopefully they would both end with the same result. The annihilation of evil men like Nick and Pete. The tunnels sweated with humidity. Water coursed over the webbing and the brick walls like tears. Beckham wished he could wipe the perspiration rolling down his nose under his full-face respirator mask. It was a good 20 degrees higher than topside, and the mugginess made it almost unbearable. The plastic splash suit he wore was like walking around in a portable sauna. At least the mask protected him from the odor of death, trash, and waste this place must be filled with. Three outpost soldiers and two soldiers from command stood guard with him in the tunnel. A heavy-set corporal named Cotter looked like he was about to pass out, his face under the mask blanched.
I'm sweating like a pig's nutsack in the summer, Cotter had protested.
Suck it up, man, Beckham had replied. You're not the only one hurting.
He couldn't wait to peel off this mask and suit. Horn would have hated it down here. The big guy could deal with pretty much anything, but he despised humidity. Then again, the retired operator probably didn't like playing babysitter either. He had been filling that role quite a bit lately. Beckham thought of Javier, Tasha, Jenny, and the dogs back in the command bunker, all cooped up with the president, her staff, military officers, and soldiers. It beat being down here, but Beckham still worried about them. No place in the Allied States was safe now. At this point, he wasn't even reassured, although Horn, Ringgold, and the kids had a veritable army protecting them. The enemy had a bigger one.
You hear that? Asked Cotter.
What? Replied another corporal named Daniels. Beckham held up a hand to silence them. He listened for whatever Cotter thought he had heard, but the only sound was a distant dripping. Cotter shrugged.
Guess it was nothing.
Maybe it was your stomach growling, Daniels said.
Shut up, Beckham said. He raised his rifle and directed his beam down the passage. A faint moaning sounded. The men backed up behind Beckham as he took a few steps ahead.
Variant?
Cotter asked. Beckham shook his head.
Sounds like another survivor.
God, Daniel said. Let me guess. We're going to rescue them.
Not yet. Stay here and stay frosty, Beckham said. I'll be right back.
Where are you going?
Cotter blurted.
Before we do anything, I need to check on the science team, Beckham said.
Beckham set off for Kate and her staff. They were located in a tunnel around the next corner, about a quarter mile from the entrance to the construction site. The glow from the construction floodlights guided him, and he shut off his tactical light. The generators powering those lights thrummed as he rounded the corner. Kate, Sammy, Ron, and Leslie hunched behind the laptops they had set up on a folding table like those the military used in their mobile outposts. It wasn't an impressive mobile lab station, but it was all they had to work with.
You guys making progress? Beckham asked.
Sammy shrugged.
This isn't as easy as I'd hoped.
I thought you had this all figured out.
In the lab we did, Kate said. But this isn't the lab. We're having trouble integrating the signals over the longer networks, Sammy said. The signal doesn't amplify like I'd predicted. Worse, the signals we're receiving are coming in at frequencies we didn't experience with the mastermind.
What's that mean? He asked.
It means if we don't get the frequencies just right and our first attempt to communicate with the variants goes wrong, they'll be able to find us, Kate said.
That didn't exactly inspire confidence, but Beckham trusted his wife.
I have faith you'll crack this, he said. But in the meantime, I've got to take a few men farther down the tunnel. Might be more survivors.
She paused.
You...
I'll be careful. Don't worry. Kate shot him a worried look, and he gave her a reassuring nod. He returned to the soldiers and motioned for Cotter and Daniels to follow. Rest of you stay here and hold sentry, Beckham instructed.
Their three beams penetrated the steamy darkness as they advanced into the subterranean labyrinth. Sweat bled down his forehead and stung one of his eyes. He blinked it away. The moaning they had heard earlier seemed to have stopped. He kept walking, just in case they were still alive. His prosthetic blade clanked on the concrete floor as he scanned the tunnel with his light to make sure no threats hid in the shadows. In the next passage, he cleared the way to another tunnel. At the next intersection, he signaled for Cotter and Daniels to take the right side while he checked the left. When he looked back to the right, he found both soldiers angling their lights at the center of the floor where a volcano of webbing grew through the bricks.
What in the hell? Beckham whispered.
The tunnel below the sewer must have been dug by the variants, which meant there could be other passages right below his boots. Another long moan sounded, this time much louder. It sounded more like the hiss of air escaping a leaking tire. Beckham walked past the other two soldiers. He flicked his beam over the walls until he saw the source. On the ceiling above the broken floor, his light captured a human face. Bloodshot eyeballs protruded from their sockets. He ran the light down the webbing, expecting to see the rest of the body covered in a cocoon of webbing. But there was nothing under the neck. No chest, torso, hips, not even any bones.
Holy, Beckham whispered.
What is it?
Cotter muttered. Daniels took another step forward, then started to retch. He pulled up his mask and vomited. Beckham froze, his brain unable to comprehend what his eyes were seeing. Of all the horrors over the years, this took the prize. He finally managed to break from the shock. The vines had somehow become part of the head, feeding it like blood vessels nourishing an organ.
How in the hell was this possible?
The eyes seemed to watch him, and the lips moved. Air pushed out of the mouth, making that horrible hissing sound. Beckham wondered if the person was asking to die. Cotter raised his rifle, looking as if he would grant that wish. The lips opened wider to reveal a jaw rimmed with jagged, broken teeth. The lips opened wider to reveal a jaw rimmed with jagged, broken teeth. The head pushed forward, propelled by some of the vines, almost as if it was lunging at the soldiers. Before Beckham could say anything, Cotter squeezed his trigger. A suppressed gunshot rang out. The ravaged face burst, flecks of gore and bone painting the soldiers.
God damn it,
Beckham grumbled. Cotter lowered his rifle.
You stupid asshole, Beckham said.
Dude, that was... A vine suddenly wrapped around his ankle and pulled his leg out from under him. Cotter screamed and dropped his gun, flailing his arms for help. Beckham pulled out his blade to free him, but crimson tendrils wrapped around his limbs too, yanking him against the wall. Daniels was suddenly lifted to the ceiling by a rope of webbing that curled around his neck and arms. He also dropped his rifle, kicking as the webbing choked him. It happened so fast, Beckham didn't even have time to save himself. The vines wrapped around him, pressing him harder against the wall. Webbing around their necks tightened, silencing any calls for help. Beckham wiggled a hand free and reached for his radio. The vine around his arm squeezed, and he dropped it. A draft of warm wind burst through the tunnel as he fought to free himself. As the webbing tightened over the bodies, the carpet of vines coursed over the tactical lights on their rifles. Darkness flooded the tunnels. Something rumbled beneath them. Paralyzed by the strength of the webbing, Beckham could only think about Kate. He had no way of warning her. Something was coming. 7. Kate took a seat next to Sammy at one of the tables. Sweat trickled down the back of her neck. She suppressed the urge to scratch it. The combination of the splash suits, respirator masks, and intense humidity and heat of the old sewers made their work nearly unbearable. Thoughts of her family helped her persevere. The future of this country relied on the scientific experiments they carried out down here. Temporary discomfort was nothing compared to what was at stake.
Even more distracting than the heat was knowing Beckham was somewhere deep in the tunnels searching for more survivors. He hadn't been gone long, but she had started to worry. And while she admired his bravery and would never fault his courage, sometimes she wished he would play it safer. But without courage like his, or really anyone's who was in the tunnels today, the Allied States would have perished long ago. All it took was for brave men and women to falter in the face of fear, and evil would triumph. "And that means you too, Kate," she thought. She snapped out of her thoughts and focused on the lines of text scrolling across Sammy's computer screen. Ron and Leslie crouched nearby, monitoring the microelectric array connections between the laptop and an organic cable of webbing. Kate wasn't a programmer like Sammy, but she was beginning to learn how to interpret the various signals they received from watching the laptop screen. "How's it coming?" Kate asked. "I think I'm ready to interact locally with the webbing," Sammy said. "Ron, check that laptop over there." Sammy pointed to a computer on a different table 30 yards away. "That means our signals are completely separate from the main network, right?" Kate asked. She worried an errant signal might put Beckham at risk. "Whatever I send through this webbing won't pass beyond the network Ron and Leslie isolated," Sammy said. "We've got physical microelectric arrays that we can control and position to gate the communications." Kate nodded. "If we do our job right, no one but us will know we're interacting with the network," Leslie said. Ron bent over the laptop.
"My computer's ready."
"I'll send a test phrase," Sammy said. She typed the command.
"Got it, but..."
He leaned closer to his screen.
"I'm seeing something else, too."
"What?" Sammy asked. Kate went for a look.
"I don't know," Ron said. "External communications, I think."
"What are they saying?" Kate asked. Leslie joined Ron, looking over his shoulder.
"Looks like some of the signals are coming in clear," she said. "I see one reporting ongoing variant casualties," Ron said.
"That definitely isn't local," Kate said. "There haven't been any battles in Manhattan since last night. Can we determine where that signal originated?" Sammy tapped on her keyboard and brought up the signals that Ron and Leslie were seeing.
"You're right. This is coming from further north,"